Hiya, and welcome to New Books in South Asian Studies. I'm your host, Ian Cook. Today we're talking about Dream Zones, Anticipating Capitalism and Development in India by Jamie Cross. The book is published by Pluto Press, and Jamie Cross is a lecturer in Social Anthropology and Development at the University of Edinburgh. This book is a really beautifully written and engaging piece that takes us through many different facets of a special economic zone in South India. We learn about workers, about managers, politicians, anti-SEZ activists, and also about land, and how all these different diverse groups of people and places are imbued with the future as people anticipate future development. It really is a wonderful, wonderful book, and I can't recommend it enough. I had a pleasure of speaking with Jamie just a few minutes before. Okay, so without any further ado, it gives me great pleasure to welcome Jamie Cross to New Books in South Asian Studies. Thanks a lot for coming on the show, and thanks a lot for your wonderful book.
Thanks very much. Great to be part of this.
Great. So before we talk about your book itself, I don't know if you can tell us a little bit about yourself, about your background and how you got interested in this topic.
Let me just go back. I did a graduate course, a master's degree in social anthropology and social transformation at the University of Sussex in 2001. And during that course, I wrote a dissertation about trade unions and language and power in Nepal. And when I finished that, I spent a year working in South Asia, first in Kathmandu, doing a little bit of work for the International Labour Organization, editing reports and looking over some of the documentation they were producing. And then went from there for a few months over summer to Geneva and spent a bit of time with the International Labour Organization's Bureau for Workers' Activities and really got interested in labour, labour movements, the politics of work in South Asia. And at around the same time, I'd been had the opportunity to go to the World Social Forum in Hyderabad in Andhra Pradesh, what was then Andhra Pradesh, and came to know really for the first time of the new kinds of workspaces that were being created in the export processing zones, free trade zones, special economic zones that were being built across India at that point. And there were spaces very much like the spaces that anthropologists who I'd read had been writing about in Malaysia, Iwa Ong, or in Mexico, people like Leslie Salzinger. And I was really fascinated by what that meant in India and really excited by the possibility of doing some kind of factory-based ethnography or kind of following a tradition of factory-based research in those new and emerging workspaces and trying to figure out how some of that research could speak not just to anthropology but also to people who are interested, social activists and labour organisations who are interested and also concerned about changes in workplaces and work practices across South Asia.
Great. And it's this interest, I'd say wide interest, it comes through in all the different chapters of the book, because of course you, as we'll get to in the final chapter, you do start to speak to activist movement as well. So let's turn to the book itself. I mean, the book is it's about a special economic zone in Visakhapatnam in Andhra Pradesh. But before we discuss the zone and the factory and the people who are working and managing the factory, I was wondering if, just so to frame the book, as you do in the introduction, you're making an argument about what you call the economy of anticipation. So I was wondering, what is the economy of anticipation and how does this special economic zone fit into this?
For me, what I mean by the economy of anticipation is something that sounds straightforward and commonsensical to everyone who's writing in South Asian studies or in social anthropology and who are concerned with both modernity and also the expectations of modernity, in James Ferguson's classic phrase. And it's about the presence of the future, hopes, dreams of the future, an anticipated future in the everyday lives of people across the world and the ways in which those futures come to be present in the everyday lives of the here and now. But I, in this book, try to expand some of that previous work and stand on the shoulders of previous giants and think a bit more about the ways in which how we know about the future, how we predict or try and plan the future, come into contact with or are shaped by a kind of future-oriented imaginary, the different kinds of ways in which futures in popular discourse or in people's vernacular dreams come to be expressed, and also the ways in which some of those different futures really get carried on the skin, lived in and inhabited, and in ways that shape people's kind of physical, kind of corporeal way of being in the world. And so I try to bring together those ways of knowing, the ways of imagining, and the ways of, I suppose, kind of the lived sensation of the future, bring those together in a way that could account for actually how capitalism works, how it's possible that spaces of work and labor can actually operate successfully, how it's possible that factory managers in a small or large South Indian city can actually get people to work every day, 8 or 9 hours a day, 6 days a week, or how it's possible that people in small villages across India could be persuaded to give up land that they or their families have inhabited for a couple of generations in order to be part of some bigger industrial development project. And so for me, those kind of, the economy of anticipation was a way of actually trying to give a real weight to explaining how it is that those kinds of futures actually make the present, how it is that the contemporary economy is actually built and driven and kind of, I suppose, captured by all of those different futures.
And that's a wonderful summary of the first 20 pages or so. And I was wondering, could you tell us then a little bit, just a little bit of background about this particular special economic zone and Visakhapatnam itself?
Yeah. So at the beginning of the 2000s, 2001 or 2002, this small city of 1 million people on the east coast of India became the center of one of the first complaints to the International Labour Organization about working conditions in these new zones, these new enclaves of globalization in India. And this was a formal bureaucratic legal process that was made by the Centre for Indian Trade Unions to the International Labour Organization, which asserted that some new kind of slave labour regime was being given birth to in these new enclave spaces. And it set in motion something that continues to be ongoing, an investigative process by the International Labour Organization in conjunction with the Indian government to try and investigate a strike which took place, a labour strike, in a diamond factory in the Visakhapatnam Special Economic Zone in 2002. And that case, that landmark case, really opened up to a whole new group of social activists outside of the Indian labour movement, an interest and a kind of uncertainty about what was taking place in these new economic zones. And so that's what led me to Visakhapatnam, because that case was about a diamond factory which had been established in the Visakhapatnam Special Economic Zone in 1997, a factory that was part owned by a Belgian company and part owned by a British company, and had set up this incredible manufacturing facility to cut and polish diamonds that had been imported to India from all over the world, mostly Southern Africa, Canada, Russia, and Australia, and which had become a fantastic flagship investment for the state government, who celebrated it as exactly the kind of foreign investment that they were looking to attract. At that time, employed 1,500 people, aged somewhere between 18 and 24. And that company and that space, that zone, the story there was being repeated in myriad other places across India as state governments looked to attract particular kinds of investors to these new enclave spaces. And so that was really the story I tried to follow, and that drew me to Visakhapatnam, this industrial city on the coast of Andhra Pradesh.
Mm-hmm. And as you show in the second chapter, these special economic zones are really important tools or spaces through which regional politicians and also consultants, that they can reimagine and remake their states. So I was wondering, what do you think it is about special economic zones that allows politicians to imagine new futures for their states, and how do they manage to do this?
So the special economic zone is a bounded territory. Basically, a government can demarcate a piece of land and say, within this space, the normal laws that govern our territory, our sovereign nation, won't apply, or there'll be exceptions to them. So in that sense, a kind of exceptional space, or space of exception. And what that also means is that it creates a kind of a blank slate. It creates the conditions under which politicians, consultancy companies can give themselves free rein to imagining what an open economic space might look like, in terms of writing from the bottom up, if you like, laws and regulations that govern that space, imagining in real practical terms, physical terms, what that space will look like, how it will be laid out, and what kinds of people will come and populate it, to work in it, to manage it, to construct it, to govern it. And so I think in some ways it's the fantasy of that pure bounded space, just like islands or kind of island communities have in the past, that gives rise to a particular kind of fantasy in the minds of politicians, international financial institutions like the World Bank or the Asia Development Bank, who've been instrumental in circulating models and ideas of those spaces over the last 20, 25 years.
And this particular special economic zone, and indeed many of the special economic zones, are very large, but this one seems particularly massive, and it involves the states basically taking a lot of land, a lot of inhabited and farmed land from people. And then, so unsurprisingly, this involved a lot of negotiations, a lot of contestations. But as you show in the third chapter, it's not as straightforward as everybody being against the zone and the government coming in, or the state coming in and taking it. But actually, there was a lot of difference between the different groups who wanted to give up the land, who didn't. And so I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about these different groups and how they negotiated with the state when it came to giving up their land.
Okay, so first let me just kind of describe a whole range. There's a whole spectrum of different spaces. Mm-hmm. Up until the middle of the 90s, the Indian government, the central government, built 7 export processing zones across the country. These were often quite small spaces, you know, comparatively small, 300, 400, 500 acres. In the 2000s, changes in national legislation gave rise to a whole new array of different spaces built under public-private partnership agreements between state, Indian state governments and land developers, real estate developers. And so on the east coast of Andhra Pradesh, in the district of Vishakhapatnam, you actually find a whole plethora of different spaces, from one of the oldest zones first built in India back in the kind of mid-90s or early 90s, to some of these gigantic mega spaces that were planned during the 2000s. So this, on the small side of the scale, something like 300 acres, and then on the bigger side, these 10,000 acre spaces. And it's there where you find an incredible array of different communities of people who have either inhabited that land for a long period of time or have been resettled there as a result of previous attempts by state governments to redistribute lands, perhaps during the kind of 50s, 60s, or 70s, as the post-colonial Indian government began to legislate and try to improve the conditions, particularly for scheduled tribes and scheduled castes. And what you found, which I think was really salient for me, and which is found in many other parts of these, or many other places across India around these large-scale industrial development projects, in Vishakhapatnam, you found many different communities of people who had historically struggled against each other to either kind of regain or kind of access to land that had been lost, or were really engaged in battles with subordinate communities of people to try and get land from them in variously kind of legal or illegal ways. And on the edge of Vishakhapatnam, you found communities who were the ancestors of the historic landowners, the people who were in the kind of colonial era had been given rights to manage and control land for colonial governments, to people who had effectively been peasant farmers in the early half of the 20th century and who had benefited from the first generation of land reforms. And then the third group of people, castes, communities of people who actually had been really struggling to get access to land and who hadn't really been able to benefit from either of those different kinds of land reform processes. And so we found different communities of people, some of whom are using the emergence of new industrial development projects to derive ever greater benefits, to find new ways of pushing people off land that they've been struggling to get access to for years, to get back land that they'd originally claimed. And you found kind of smallholders or landless peasants who were desperately scratching around trying to figure out a way of actually getting some legal title to land that they'd never been fully assured of.
And what's interesting, and what you also show in this chapter, is even though a lot of the land was notified to become part of the special economic zone, then because they couldn't actually manage to attract, you know, one big investor, a lot of that land was then denotified, and suddenly then it was open for all different types of use apart from the special economic zone as well.
Yeah, so this is part of what has given these spaces so much attention in contemporary India, that state governments acquire land for the purposes of a large industrial development project like a special economic zone. And then over a number of years, they suddenly discover that maybe building that zone or building the infrastructure that had originally been planned was neither so attractive to investors as had originally been imagined, or perhaps was not really what had been imagined for that space in the first place. And gradually the rationale for the project changes, and the land itself becomes used for something different. And that is what has made these zones real sites of criticism, sites where we can identify across India government officials, bureaucrats, politicians and their families in the know and their friends who say yes to a project of one kind and are able a few years or months even down the line to get access to that land that's very low cost and redistribute it to their cronies or friends and use it for some other purpose. So you find cases of people buying up land at very low cost that the government has applied for a big industrial project and then selling it on at cheap rates to build houses, kind of new property, estates, townships, etc., etc. Now, I think for me, what's different in my argument and in my book from the critiques that are often made in India is that I think sometimes we can over-egg how instrumental those processes are. What you find in Andhra Pradesh are both projects that are conceived for one reason and then corrupts or kind of effectively politicians who are kind of hand in hand with friends and cronies in the private sector use that land for something different. But you also find people who put all their whose policies, whose desires for rural development are thrown into one particular project, and they discover over time that the originally conceived project was nowhere near as attractive as the one that they'd actually imagined, and the circumstances themselves change, forcing some redesign in the project. And you saw that particularly during the 2000s as different Indian states competed against each other, and some parts of the country just proved much more attractive to foreign investment than others. So the area around Mumbai, for example, was much more attractive than the area around Chhattisgarh and Andhra Pradesh. And some of the large projects that were imagined to be very successful there at one period in time later on proved completely unattractive to investors at all, forcing the state government and the kind of group of investors who put money into it to rethink what that was going to be used for.
And just sticking on land 1 minute before we turn to the lives of people inside the special economic zone itself, I was wondering if you can tell us a little bit about the resettlement colonies that people who had their land taken for the special economic zone, a little bit about how they were, yeah, how they were made and what lives were like there. Because it's quite interesting because you got quite a long sweep. You knew that area quite well.
I think let's be clear. There are lots of cases across India where the plan for a special economic zone and the subsequent process of displacement and kind of forced resettlement as the government compels people to move away from their land at whatever price they're able to eventually settle on it is immensely disruptive and proves completely disadvantageous for many people who find themselves forced into either kind of new kinds of unemployment or underemployment, or find themselves employed as incredibly in vulnerable ways, or newly employed in particularly vulnerable ways in the global economy. But I think there is another side to that story, which is that process of resettlement and displacement affects different people in different ways, and people in particular kind of social, economic, political contexts and historical contexts in different ways. And across South India, I think you can find communities who at some point see those processes of rupture as potentially offering some kind of shift in their own or in their own relationships with other castes. And I think we see that particularly in coastal Andhra Pradesh, but I think the literature and other studies across South India shows that for Dalit communities across that part of India, you find people who see in that moment of rupture some kind of emancipatory potential as the historic sedimented relationships with higher castes, with farming communities who have look down on them socially, who have enjoyed a history of hierarchical relationships, somehow, which are really spatially locked in space, see those being reshaped or reconfigured. And in the resettlement colonies around the Andhra Pradesh Special Economic Zone outside Vishakhapatnam, I think that's one location where you certainly saw that, where Dalit communities, Madigas and Malas, found themselves able to imagine a new kind of relationship to the Kapu and Velama communities who had enjoyed power over them in many different ways, both in terms of their access to land, to the kind of the most fertile, the least rocky land, but who'd also been able to gain the system of a whole series of redistributive processes in order to end up better off. And so for many people who resettled in a purpose-built, purpose-planned resettlement colony outside of this new zone, people moved there, jumbled together. There was caste communities who lived in segregated hamlets and villages were now thrown together, living on opposite sides of the streets or kind of next door from each other in ways that higher castes or kind of people who saw themselves as kind of in a kind of position of higher status suddenly found incredibly imperiled by and were both unhappy and felt themselves insecure or sullied by that new proximity. And Dalit communities and the communities particularly of young men who found that experience of proximity incredibly emancipating.
Thanks for that. So let's move from outside to inside the special economic zone itself. And you worked for a year in a diamond factory. I suppose it's the same diamond factory that you mentioned before.
Same one.
And it's a really nice chapter because we get to meet George, this British manager who's come over to save the factory or to modernize the factory, take it to the future. And he seems to take to you. He seems to really seems like a wonderful sort of fieldwork moment. Yeah, I guess I imagine you were quite worried that you approached the manager. He may say yes, he may say no, but he seemed to be really happy to have you there in the factory. So I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the factory and also then how it's managed, how George manages and how the other managers manage, and how this works in relation to the future.
So in 2004, I spent 6 months in Vishakhapatnam learning Telugu and trying to kind of find my way around the city, but with an eye on this factory, which had, as I said at the beginning, been the basis for a test case against the International Labour Organization. And after finding my way around the city and figuring out some kind of formal affiliations to the local state university, I finally plucked up the courage to turn up one day at the zone and just make a formal arrangement for an interview with the management of this worldwide diamonds factory. And by complete luck, I found myself there a couple of weeks after this new manager from the UK had been recruited and had turned up to transform this factory into a new kind of model factory of the future. And because he had not been in India for very long and it was his first time there, and perhaps because he saw an opportunity to demonstrate his knowledge and skill and wisdom to a young kind of whippersnapper of a student from the UK, he opened the doors of this factory to me. And for that, I'm obviously very grateful to him. And that was something that's, he took a reasonable amount of risk in doing, and it opened up that space for me. But it was a very complicated relationship. I think both of us were, in some ways, perhaps wary of each other over that time. I think he never made any demands on me. He never asked me to show him or tell him anything particularly about the factory. In some respects, he had very little respect for me. He didn't think there was anything I could tell him about that place that he didn't already know for himself. And it was often a battle of wits, as he'd like to tell me all the different things about the place that he knew that I didn't. But I was given the opportunity. I asked if I could be put onto the factory floor in one of the departments and learn to cut and polish diamonds in the same way that any new apprentice would. And so I began in, I think, early 2005, a kind of an apprenticeship, if you like, on the floor of the preparation department, where rough diamonds were put onto the factory floor, where they had their, these tiny, tiny little diamonds that would appear in this factory looking like salt crystals. And in this particular department, they'd be have their edges rubbed off, so they'd be their circumference would be round and smooth, and they gradually have these facets ground into their top until they began to take this rudimentary diamond shape. And I began to go there every day, 6 days a week, joining the factory A shift, getting up at 5 o'clock to leave my house to be on time for the 6 o'clock start, and leaving at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, go home, completely exhausted, and then try and write up some notes from that day. And over the course of several months, I learned how to complete a number of tasks in that particular department, starting in this one section, the cornering section, which was my kind of entry point to the factory, where these corners were kind of cut off, ground off these rough diamonds. And then moved from there into a bruting section, which gives them their different facets, and a sorting section, which sorts diamonds into different grades and qualities, and really kind of immersed myself in the everyday life of the shift and the social life of people on it, people who I got to know in some cases really well outside of the factory as well. So this man who I call George in the book was both my gateway, and somebody who over the course of that year I had to make sure I didn't necessarily upset, and whom I'm not in contact with anymore, but I no longer know how he feels about being kind of, I think I do justice to his attempt. And my final words from him when I left that factory and we said goodbye were to tell it as it is, and that's what I tried to do.
Well, I think you do, and you put the words in his mouth. I mean, very often he has a wonderful way of his own unique way of management speak, I suppose. And there's lots of nice quotes from him in there.
He had we sat down many times and did recorded interviews. I had this pretty much a kind of incredible access to the factory's management, with all of whom I recorded several interviews, and the transcripts of which I've been able to use in some cases verbatim. And then on the factory floor itself, this process of being a kind of participant observer, kind of being part of the everyday life of the workplace, and then trying to figure out how to represent and record that afterwards.
Mm-hmm. So this this management, this new type of management that George was trying to bring in, I mean, in the end, we find out at the end of the chapter it ended in failure, and he was sent back to the UK. But he was very anxious of basically left wing organizations, the communist trade union and so on, organizing inside the factory, and he was very conscious of possible future agitations, I suppose, in the hiring process, and also in the way how he organized the work within the factory. I was wondering, can you tell us a little bit about that?
Yeah, what was really, really amazing for me was just how much power labor really has in these spaces. We often think of management in the global sweatshop as being top down, as being this structure of kind of control and discipline that's imposed on the workplace. But what's really interesting is that those structures of control and discipline are incredibly responsive to anxieties and fears of worker unrest. And so actually, if you look at them closely, what you see are the kind of management decisions and strategies that attempt to respond in advance or anticipate the possibility of workers gaining more control. And actually, I think it's that fear or anxiety of losing control over these spaces which really drive a whole set of management decisions, plans and strategies for controlling and organizing the workplace. And I think that's something that we often kind of play down or underestimate. But for me, there was something quite fragile about the managerial assertions and about their capacities to transform these spaces. So this is a workplace which, you know, until the end of the 90s, diamond manufacturing was organized in kind of in a very kind of similar way around the world. You'd have small clusters of people who were trained to cut and polish a diamond from beginning to end. And then at the end of the last century, you began to find introduced into the diamond industry a whole new set of strategies for organizing the workplace that borrowed from the organization of workplaces and industries and other kinds of sectors, everything from glass and kind of vehicle manufacturing to kind of clothing and kind of microelectronics, so that the assembly line became a kind of predominant model for organizing diamond manufacturing. People were organized into effectively long lines, and diamonds kind of were passed from one group of people to the next, so that no one in particular would know how to cut and polish a diamond from beginning to end, but would have a kind of uniquely specialized understanding of one part of that process. And that's what had been kind of taking place in this factory. And what George began to do was to up the ante a little bit and add to that dynamic, to that kind of new model of assembly line diamond manufacturing, a whole new layer of management expertise and strategy, which was about fostering new kinds of feelings amongst the workers, new kinds of feelings of a kind of affection and affinity to their company, a try to instill new kinds of competition between different parts of the factory in order to drive up productivity, make work the place work more efficiently and effective, and also to ratchet up profits.
It's great. And then the next chapter is when you really are deep, I say the deepest ethnography, maybe it's all deep ethnography, but this is when you learn a lot about the lives of the factory workers who you knew very well and I imagine were extremely close to as well. It certainly reads like that. And you explore, I suppose, the aspirations on amongst the lives of the people who come to work here. You start with this wonderful anecdote when actually the workers were called into to one manager's office and asked to give their future hopes or aspirations, and it turned into a big joke on the factory floor. And but this chapter is really nice. I like it because there's, especially because you'd learned so much about three particular men, and I presume they're representative of many other people as well. The aspiration and this sort of dreams of future success are such a strong, amazingly strong motivating force in their lives. So I was wondering, could you expand a bit on this? Can you tell us a little bit about your fellow workers?
I think this chapter was really driven by my experience on this factory floor. I arrived in this factory having spent time writing about and working with trade unions in South Asia, but also working with the International Labour Organization, really expecting to write a kind of expose of the global sweatshop. And, you know, there's much kind of evidence. It would have been, in some respects, a kind of straight, you know, it's an easy place to write a straightforwardly journalistic account of kind of low pay and hard work and the kind of implications of that. But what was really striking for me in this place was that, well, two things really. One is that although this is a place in which people have on at least two occasions in the last 10 years, stopped work and gone on strike, have organized themselves collectively in this workplace to try and agitate for better working conditions. The rest of the time, everyone goes to work. Everyone consents to the terms and conditions of work as they stand. And for me, what's really important is to try and figure out not just how those extraordinary moments are organized, not just to pay attention to those moments when people put down their tools and refuse to work, but also to pay attention to those other mundane moments when people actually don't put down their tools, but actually go to work and stay at work for 8 or 9 hours and go back again and again and again, day after day, 6 days a week, and then for the next week and the next week after that. And the second part of my surprise, if you like, at working myself inside this place was just how kind of social it was. It was in many ways a bit like a classroom at times. There were kind of the kind of personal relationships between people on the factory floor, the kind of the jokes and banter that people used to enliven their days, the kinds of relationships that people carried into this place from the outside, that sometimes people, you know, 18, 19 year olds who had never had the opportunity or were never part of a class who would have had the opportunity to go to a college, talked about it as a college space, a diamond college or a work college, a place where they could enjoy proximity to people they might not meet outside the workplace, proximity to members of the other sex or to members of other castes. And so those two things really kind of transformed the way I began to think about this. And part of that led me to try and explore the other kinds of things that people carry into this workspace. And I've used that word aspiration, but the kind of aspirations that people carry. Now that word has come, I think, to have quite a lot of baggage. You know, the kind of aspirational economy is something that gets celebrated and championed by people who want to kind of laud the possibility and potential for India's future transformation. Well, obviously, aspiration comes with a whole host of anxieties and ambiguities and uncertainties and disappointments as people fail to realize the kind of aspirations that they project onto their own futures or that the kinds of futures that their parents project onto them. And the workplaces like these are places in which all those different things come to play out. And the story I wanted to really focus on was driven by an attempt to understand how these places work. So as I said in the beginning, this economy of anticipation, what it is about the quality of people's aspirations that make this workplace tick, that make it possible for people to cut and polish diamonds without putting down their tools, make it possible for managers to reorganize spaces in more effective and efficient ways. What is it about the quality of people's aspirations that makes that possible? And also makes people, I suppose, in some ways, complicit in the organization of those spaces and makes their labor consensual rather than just coerced. Mm-hmm. And it was that interest in the kind of the power of anticipation that really kind of drives this chapter and what I try and do there.
Mm-hmm. And I just would flag this up for the listeners. This, I mean, I think it's the most brilliantly written chapter in the book. The whole book's very nicely written. It just reads so well in a way that I suppose we can't describe, because it's very much a literary, beautifully literally constructed chapter. So I really would strongly recommend the book anyway, but especially for the way these different elements come through in the writing. But let's turn to the penultimate chapter, or the final substantive chapter of the book, when you start to explore the struggles against special economic zones. This was also part of your research, not just inside the factory, but you talk about how you were part of the audit which was going on, and these fact-finding mission, that's different than an audit, but you were part of this, and you were present often at these meetings amongst activists who were campaigning against them. And I was wondering, can you tell us a little bit about what motivates these campaigns, and how successful or not were they in opposing SEZs?
Okay, so the time I spent on the floor of this factory in Vishakhapatnam during 2005, I left and wrote up this PhD at the University of Sussex in the UK. And my PhD work had really been focused on questions of labour. But at the time I was kind of beginning to finish that PhD, and the kind of conflicts around land really exploded across India, 10, 20, 30 different locations, 40, 50, saw these conflicts and struggles over the kind of often forced acquisition of land for these large-scale industrial infrastructure projects. And that gave rise to, or focused the attention of, social and political activists on the Indian left, often outside of formal kind of left-wing political parties like the Communist Party, people who align to a whole range of social movements and grassroots movements, who frequently come together under the umbrella of the kind of non-aligned movements, or the a whole range of other kind of titles and names, but who had begun to coalesce around the kind of an attempt to push back legislation around special economic zones in India. These zones really became a focus point for struggles over neoliberalism and neoliberal globalization in India, struggles against the state's kind of drive to force upon different communities, people and populations, market-oriented development policies. And the zone became, the special economic zone became came to epitomize the kinds of projects and politics of the government and their relationship to private sector kind of actors. And so in 2009, 2010, you saw this coming together in a particular kind of anti-special economic zone movement, which attempted to basically audit the impact of zones across the country and document the impact of these projects, both on people working inside them and also people who've been dispossessed of their land as a result of them. But I also wanted to, in 2009, I was for a large portion of that year in Andhra Pradesh, and became involved in the audit process there, helping to just discuss with a whole range of different grassroots campaigners and social activists, discuss how the audit process would go forwards and how it would be kind of best organized, and also documented that process as an anthropologist and write about it in this chapter. But what became apparent to me during that process was that the campaigners and activists who were part of that movement were making real tactical decisions about how those zones should be represented. And their decisions were made in order to leverage the greatest kind of impact of their own campaigns, of the audit process, to attract the most attention in the media, to try and force the results which they were focused on, which was a repeal of the SEZ Act, the Special Economic Zone Act of 2005 and its subsequent amendments. And what that also meant was that some of the kind of complex lives of people who worked inside these spaces, or the social politics of people who were pushed off land for these zones, I felt began to be kind of fall to the wayside a little bit, and a particular kind of story of these spaces began to kind of come to the surface. And while I was in many ways incredibly supportive of that kind of political struggle, I also wanted to try and find a way of writing this chapter to try and explore the ways in which activists, just like workers, just like managers, just like the dispossessed or the displaced, and just like politicians, also projected onto these zones a kind of anticipated future, kind of particular ideas of and kind of hopes, aspirations, dreams about what kind of politics they could catalyze, what kind of new political movements they could give birth to and give rise to, and what kind of dystopian futures they also were breeding. And so I try to describe some of that in this book, and just try to kind of do justice to some of those different kinds of politics. But at the same time, I also wanted to show how varied the politics around these zones are. The social and political activists on the left are not the only kinds of people involved in political struggles around these spaces. As I described elsewhere in the book, you also have the politics of high or middle-income caste communities who try and use the coming of a zone to either kind of re-establish and reassert their own power over land and space and territory. But on the inside these spaces, you also have labour movements which are not always as kind of entirely progressive as they always appear. And I think that if we tease open some of the politics of labour and organised trade union movements, we also see attempts to protect employment opportunities for men over women, and you certainly see some of those gendered politics of labour playing out in the ways in which kind of campaigns against particular kinds of kind of exploitation against women in the workplaces were flagged or signalled or articulated, and the ways in which men and male workers were kind of represented as the only kinds of person able to really hold and carry the burden of work inside these new kinds of spaces.
Well, thanks so much for that. I mean, I always have this problem. We sort of shot through what is a very rich and detailed ethnography in like 40 minutes or so. So I was wondering if there's anything that I've skipped over with my questions that you'd like to flag up for the listeners.
Just to say, I suppose that this book was intended as a book about a particular kind of industrial infrastructure project in contemporary India. It's a book about a very particular part of India and the experiences of people there. But it's also, and I also wrote it in an attempt to open up vocabulary for people writing about large-scale industrial infrastructure projects elsewhere in India and in other parts of the world too, to flag and to open up a kind of methodological approach to really make a claim for ethnography as a way of writing that also intervenes in the world. It's not just, I'm not content to allow or to just kind of step back and allow other genres, the genres of kind of dystopian futures, so kind of widely used in bodies of activist propaganda and kind of proper propaganda in the sense of kind of tactical strategic writing, but also the genres of journalism that's often make particular claims to kind of represent and write about these spaces. And for me, what's really powerful about ethnography as a literary genre, as well as a kind of a social science or kind of as a kind of anthropological methodology, is its capacity to tell stories about places, people, to those who aren't necessarily able to kind of to hear them at first hand, but also to try and to kind of complicate some of the narratives that saturate our contemporary world. And that they're not just the narratives that champion a particular politics or particular market future, but also the counter narratives, the narratives that try and contest them and oppose them.
Mm-hmm. And hello?
Hello, yeah.
Oh, sorry, the line went a bit bad. And I just also like, I suppose, to reiterate your point to the listeners that this is a really it's an easy read. It's not a complicated read. You don't need a PhD in anthropology to read this at all. It's accessible. It's accessible for people not just involved in you know, postgraduate education, but anyone could sort of pick this up and get engaged in the arguments. It's not this sort of heavy jargon-filled text. So it really does. It really is a book that hopefully will be widely read as well. And it's already straight out in paperback as well. We don't have to wait years down the line for that, which is also great. So we've taken up a lot of your time, and so I'd just like to ask, what's the traditional last question on the podcast? Is what future or current projects are you working on now?
Well, for the last 3 years, I suppose, since I've been kind of finishing this book project off and in some ways drawing a line under some of my work in Shikapatnam and around these kind of industrial infrastructure projects. And since then, I've been focusing on a different kind of project that has been reshaping contemporary India, that also has is reshaping the futures of development and capitalism. And they're the kind of futures that get built into new technologies that are being built and designed for very, very poor people living on less than $2 a day, people who don't have access to electricity. The kind of so I've been focusing for the last couple of years on solar powered energy systems, technologies, particularly lighting systems, that are technologies that are seen as kind of transformative and emancipatory, and are being kind of built and sold to people across India today with a kind of hope and a set of hopes and visions attached to them about how they might transform people's lives. And the book I'm writing right now is a book that follows some of these kind of solar-powered lanterns and lights across India, from places where they're kind of designed and built and manufactured, to places where they're sold and places where they're bought and used, to kind of explore how they make particular claims about what certain kinds of technology can do, what poor people want, and what markets can achieve in the future.
Wonderful. Sounds brilliant. Well, we look forward to that. I guess a couple of years down the line when that comes out. That sounds great. So, yeah, nothing left to do apart from to thank you very much for your book, and thanks a lot for coming on the podcast.
Thanks very much, Ian. Thanks a lot.
Bye-bye. Thanks so much for listening to New Books in South Asian Studies. I've been your host, Ian Cook. Today we've been talking about Dream Zones by Jamie Cross, published by Pluto Press. It's a great book, and I strongly recommend you check it out. Thanks again for listening, and hopefully you'll tune in again next time. Ta-ra.